This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, Queensland's bid to buy a stake in the troubled airline Virgin Australia. And a new study shows that far too many of us are in the habit of going to work sick.
I always go to work regardless of how sick I am, and I tend to think I'm better off at work than I am at staying at home.
It's a culture attitude. All of us have done this, I think. We need to get over that.
Tensions between the US and China have been ratcheted up again with claims the Chinese Communist Party is behind attempts to steal intellectual property on a potential coronavirus vaccine. US government agencies are warning all organisations working on COVID-19 to ensure they're properly protected against cyber attacks. North America correspondent David Lipson reports.
Reports of the imminent warning have been swirling in US media all week. Today, it dropped. A joint statement from the FBI and Department of Homeland Security claiming Chinese government-affiliated hackers have tried to steal public health data and intellectual property relating to COVID-19. The statement claimed work on vaccines, treatments and testing was under threat, jeopardising the delivery of secure, effective and efficient treatment options.
It is absolutely in line with what we've seen them do in the past.
John Holtquist is Senior Director for Analysis at FireEye, a cybersecurity company with government and commercial clients.
And I think right now that COVID-19 is the existential threat. So these guys are going to refocus a lot of capability in that direction.
He says with all nations facing the same threat, global espionage efforts are now primarily focused on the same prize, information about COVID-19.
We saw Vietnamese actors target China as early as January. They're targeting the Chinese ministry that's involved in a lot of the response to COVID-19. They're also targeting the Wuhan provincial government.
He says Russia and Iran have also been detected seeking COVID-19 secrets, all of which suggests there's much more cyber activity going on undetected.
Based on the breadth of activity that we're already seeing, we suspect that this is a very, very big iceberg.
That iceberg is sinking any remaining hopes of US-China cooperation, according to the senior vice president of CSIS, Michael Green.
It's a bit like the Titanic, which had watertight compartments to prevent the ship from sinking. But when an iceberg cut across all of those watertight compartments, it went down quickly and no area is safe.
Globally, he says the cyber warning will only add to the dim view many nations already hold towards China. But he says US attempts to damage multinational bodies like the World Trade Organization will hamper efforts to fight back.
The Western European countries, North America, Japan, Australia, we are largely seeing China acting more aggressively. I think there's more of a willingness to push back and do it collectively. But unfortunately, the US and to some extent other countries are undermining the very institutions that would allow us to do that, like the WTO.
Many hoped the pandemic would bring nations together to fight a common cause. That's yet to be seen. This is David Lipson in Washington for AM.
The Queensland government is making a rescue bid for the troubled airline Virgin Australia, but there are questions already about the potential risk to taxpayers given the uncertainties of COVID-19. The proposal to keep Virgin headquartered in Brisbane comes as the airline's administrators consider bids from a range of potential buyers, including some with extensive aviation experience. With more, I was joined a short time ago by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, good morning. This would be a huge undertaking by the Queensland government. How much money is it willing to put up for Virgin?
Well, good morning, Sabra. Last month, when Virgin unsuccessfully begged the federal government for a $1.4 billion rescue loan, the Queensland government put $200 million on the table. Now, that's barely lunch money given Virgin's debts of $6.8 billion. So the Queensland Treasurer Cameron Dick has instructed the state-owned Queensland Investment investment corporation to manage the bid, and that could see the government take a direct equity stake, a loan or a guarantee, something that Scott Morrison rejected. Queensland Investment Corporation boss Damien Frawley says it's a significant opportunity, but given that such an investment would mean exposure in the billions of dollars, there are, of course, major risks, especially when global aviation is in crisis. The Deputy Prime Minister and Federal Transport Minister Michael McCormack indicated this morning that governments, both state and federal, should stay away and leave it to the market.
They're a government, and I agree with Deb Frecklington. They should stick to trying to run Queensland and Queensland's economy. I think this should be left to companies, should be left to potential bidders and investors who aren't necessarily government.
That's the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack. Peter, what about the experts? How serious do they think this bid is?
Well, Sabra, a lot of scepticism and surprise, but with the Queensland election in October, this is also about politics and jobs to keep Virgin based in Queensland and to protect regional flights. But with a Melbourne Cup lineup of interested parties, including around eight serious ones to be narrowed down tomorrow, aviation analyst and industry veteran Neil Hansford thinks the bid is half-baked political tyre-kicking.
I'm actually staggered that they would make this announcement. You know, the parties have been formed and some of them are very experienced, exposed to aviation. And here we are, have the Queensland Investment Corporation with no proven aviation experience. $200 million in a business that's just failed, that's the petty cash. Airlines is not a business the government should be involved. Unless you are a national government, this isn't a viable bid. And this is a very major risk of taxpayers' money in the state of Queensland.
That's aviation analyst Neil Hansford. And Peter, we've seen a lot of bipartisanship during COVID-19, but it seems this idea has morphed pretty quickly into a political spat.
That's right, and the politics is being played out on social media, on Twitter, with the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton describing Queensland's bid as laughable for a chaotic and corrupt government. Treasurer Cameron Dick had a bit of a comeback, and he told Mr Dutton he should stick to cruise ships, a dig at lax border restrictions that led to the spread of COVID-19.
And that's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. At the start of the pandemic, governments, businesses and unions worked together to craft solutions to save jobs and the economy. The government's flagging future major IR changes as yet undetailed to help with the recovery. Now, fast food giant McDonald's is pushing ahead with a controversial plan to cut overtime rates and change roster rules. It's got the support of the federal government, but leaving unions bitterly divided. Gavin Coote reports.
The food industry has been one of the worst hit sectors during the COVID-19 pandemic, and Jared Dwyer, the National Secretary of the Retail Workers Union, SDA, thinks working conditions will have to change because of it.
We're all about trying to maintain jobs and maintain a connection with the workplace during the pandemic. And obviously, those changes are temporary.
The Australian Industry Group, representing McDonald's, is pushing for changes to the fast food award, waiving overtime rates and removing set rosters for part-time workers. The case is set to be heard by the Fair Work Commission tomorrow.
If the Commission is of a view that we need to have some more protections, there are protections in place now, but the SDA and the ACTU are of a view now that if it is to proceed, we do need some additional protections to be put in place.
The Morrison government is backing McDonald's bid for change, arguing it could help avoid job losses. In a submission to the Fair Work Commission, the Industrial Relations Minister, Christian Porter, says given the extraordinary nature of the current circumstances, it's in the public interest to find what he calls practical solutions. Jared Dwyer points out this is just one of many awards that'll be varied because of the pandemic.
And this award actually has far superior provisions for workers than many previous variations. So the fact is, we've got a variation there that already has some protections. Yes, we want to improve some of those protections in front of the Commission. And we then will be able to have in place something that is focused on jobs and focused on making sure people have jobs and are still in employment at the end of the pandemic.
Not everyone in the union movement is happy with the proposed changes.
It's effectively about replacing part-time staff with a form of employment that is casual without the casual loading. And they're doing it under cover of COVID, which just makes it all the more appalling.
Josh Cullinan is the secretary of the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union, a separate workers' body. He thinks there are already laws in place that deal with any potential COVID-19 outbreak.
And that store can be closed. Those workers can be stood down on leave or on no pay. They don't need these new arrangements. These new arrangements are more specifically going to deal with workers where there isn't a store closure, where there isn't an emergency that applies to that store. That's partly why we're so concerned about their use and how they might be used to target current part-time staff, which only make up 25% of the staff at McDonald's.
But Jared Dwyer from the SDA says his union is only motivated by the desire to protect jobs.
They're not a union. They're a lobby group, okay? They're a little protagonist group. The industry union, the SDA, will certainly be playing our part to maximise employment during what's been a very difficult period for the Australian community and the economy.
That's Jared Dwyer from the Union SDA speaking there with Gavin Coote. Right now, we're being told to stay home if we have even the slightest symptoms of a cold or flu. But a new study shows that far too many of us are in the habit of going to work sick. If you do, you might be infecting colleagues, fellow commuters, and anyone within your orbit. While the research was conducted before the coronavirus outbreak, disturbingly, the international study finds that healthcare workers are some of the worst offenders when it comes to clocking on while unwell. Nick Grimm prepared this report.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
And that's $24.30. Thank you.
From her position behind a Perspex screen, pharmacy assistant Gabby sees an endless array of customers who come to buy supplies for what ails them, no matter what it might be.
I'll just give you your change. Did you want the receipt?
No, thanks.
You have to try not to think about it and keep your distance and remind people to keep their distance and then clean straight after a customer. But you have to help people too. Somebody has to do it.
But when she's not feeling well, Gabby knows the best prescription is to stay home and rest.
There's no magical pill, is there? I think, yeah, you want to soldier on. You want, even us, we think if we've got a little bit of a cold starting, we want to keep going to work and soldiering on, but you have to really think. Stay home. Even one day sometimes, the next day you'll feel better.
Soldier on, soldier on, soldier on.
It's decades old, but this television advertising jingle still resonates with many Australians, some like this customer, who's never wanted to let a bit of ill health get in the way of a day in the office.
I always go to work regardless of how sick I am, and I tend to think I'm better off at work than I am at staying at home.
Why is that?
I'm not sure. I just feel as if I'm better off working than sitting at home, and I just don't like sitting at home doing nothing.
It's a culture attitude. All of us have done this, I think. All of us have soldiered on and said, oh, I'm not that sick and, you know, I'm indispensable or the place will fall apart if I'm not there. I need to be at work. We need to get over that.
That's Peter Collignon, one of Australia's foremost experts on infectious diseases. The ANU professor is one of the co-authors of new research which examined the phenomenon known as presenteeism across 49 different countries, including Australia. It found that close to 100% of workers still turn up to their jobs despite suffering cold and flu symptoms.
But what was even more of a concern is the large proportion that would even go to work even when they were very sick, you know, with fevers and, you know, quite severe headaches, aches and pains, even chills. And surprisingly, it was the healthcare workers that would do that more often than the non-healthcare workers. So with COVID, this is even more critical, because if you look what happens in Australia with the different clusters of COVID, almost invariably there's been someone who's gone to work when they've been unwell. They may not have been desperately sick, but they've, you know, had a headache, a cold, cough, etc. And they've often been at work for 1, 2, even 5 days and spread it to both patients and other staff members, and they've had outbreaks anything from 20 people only in one case to over 90 people.
That's Professor Peter Collignon from the Australian National University's Medical School. Nick Grimm reporting there. You're listening to AM. Thanks for your company this morning, and it's 13 past 8. In England, workers have begun returning to their jobs at the order of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The return to work happened as the UK death toll passed 33,000. But there's concern Mr. Johnson's moving too fast to get the economy firing again. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
Forget mind the gap. Now the message is all about minding your distance.
Social distancing.
Boris Johnson's ordered them back to work, and so in their thousands they went. On a day, the death toll crossed the 33,000 mark. Not everyone was comfortable to be returning.
I mean, I think it's a risky strategy, but I think if people know their rights as employees, you don't have to go back if you think it's unsafe.
On social media, images of commuters pouring off buses and trains came early in the morning. And by lunchtime, the Prime Minister was on his feet in the House of Commons to defend his decisions.
I don't want to see crowding on mass transit, public transport in our capital or anywhere else. And we're working very actively with TfL to ensure that what we do is we have more capacity. We discourage people from going to work during the peak.
He doesn't want to see it, but while workers are being urged to avoid public transport, for many, it's the only way to get around. The Labour opposition leader, Keir Starmer.
After the confusion of the last few days, gaining public confidence in them is crucial. Crucial. The Prime Minister says his decisions were, and I quote, driven by the science, the data and public health. So to give the public confidence in the decisions, can the Prime Minister commit to publishing the scientific advice that the decisions were based on?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, all sage advice is published in due course, as the Right Honourable Gentleman knows.
And Keir Starmer wants to know why the government is no longer referring to international comparison graphs that have been, until now he says, shown at the daily COVID-19 press conference.
Yesterday, the government stopped publishing the international comparison and the slide is gone. Why?
Minister.
He seeks to make comparisons with other countries which I'm advised are premature.
The UK has the highest number of deaths in Europe and the second in the world after the US. This is Samantha Hawley in London reporting for AM.
And the United States remains the country hardest hit by COVID-19 with more than 83,000 dead. One of those living at the epicentre of the crisis in New York City is John Berry. He's a former US ambassador to Australia and the president of the American-Australian Association. He joined me a short time ago. John Berry, welcome to AM.
Thank you so much, Sabra. It's a great privilege to be with you and your wonderful listeners this morning.
You're a proud New Yorker. It sounds like most days that you walk through your neighbourhood for exercise and through City Hall Park. How has that walk changed in the past 6 months?
I think this virus has touched everyone in this city and probably one of the worst hit places on the planet. It's been a beautiful spring and it's been a cool spring. So the flowers have stayed up and grown longer. The tulips in City Hall Park, right across from where I live, where the Brooklyn Bridge comes into Manhattan, are still blooming right now. My dog and I walk through there and then around Pace University, and as we turn the corner, we're hit with a solemn reminder of the impact with a trailer that is being used as a temporary morgue. So it's a daily reminder that sort of just like in the Dickens novel, as the tale of two cities begins, is the best of times, it was the worst of times. It's a little bit of both right now here in New York.
And on the best of times, every night there in New York at 7 o'clock, a ritual happens. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's really heartwarming, Sabra. Every night at 7, people throw open their windows and they grab whatever they can to make whatever noise they can. Some are just yell, some clap, some play musical instruments, but it's all to try to make as much noise as you can for a minute to thank all of the frontline healthcare workers. On that walk this morning, I ran into a nurse who was just coming on to her shift. The good news this morning was it's the first time in 2 months that one of the healthcare workers I've spoken to was in good spirits. She said, "Oh, it's gotten so much better. The pressure has fallen in the emergency room. The death rate in New York back at the beginning of April was 800 people a day were dying. As of today, we're at 173. still a horrific number, but it's one where people feel we've turned the corner, at least in New York.
As you point out, America's had the highest COVID-19 death toll around the world, and a third of those lives lost have been in New York. You've pointed out that more lives have been lost there than lost in battle, even the worst battle in the US Civil War. Do ordinary Americans understand the context of how devastating the loss of life has been?
Yes, I think, not just the Battle of Antietam that you reference in the Civil War, which is the single bloodiest day in American history. You'd have to add together, Sabra, Antietam, Pearl Harbor, Guadalcanal, Normandy, Iwo Jima, all of the Iraq War, and all of the Afghanistan War, just to equal the number of lives lost in New York State. To equal the number of the United States, you'd have to multiply those three, all of those battles taken together, you'd multiply it by three, would equal the deaths across the United States. So it gives you a real sense of this is monumental, this is historic, it's something our country has never faced before, and people are very much aware of it.
John Berry, I'm keen for your insights on the difficulties that Australia is experiencing with China right now, the trade difficulties and suggestions it's because of Australia's push for an independent inquiry into how the pandemic started, and because Australia is viewed as America's sheriff in the Pacific. Will Australia become collateral damage in all of this? And with Mr. Trump's America First policy, do you think we'll find ourselves isolated?
I don't think Australia will ever be isolated, and I think Australia does a magnificent job leading on so many fronts. I will say this, I think without getting into the policy situations, because I don't want to get, there's one U.S. ambassador right now, and that's A.B. Culverhouse, and he speaks for the administration and for U.S. policy there. But I can say this, that Americans are keenly aware that Australia is playing a very strong leadership role in the entire response to COVID. Everyone is very impressed. There's regular coverage of the amazing leadership that the PM has shown. I think a lot of people are really impressed with the JobKeeper program that you all have so well instituted, and you've really led with science and medical expertise, which has been amazing. And you're leading in an international way, trying to get to the bottom of the basic question, which everybody wants to know is, how did this start, and how do we prevent something from like this from going forward in the future? We need to figure out, how did it break out? Where was the link? Is it wet markets? You know, you see countries all around the globe are joining Australia in helping to get to the bottom of those answers. I know the United States wants to get to the bottom of those answers and make sure that we're ready to hopefully prevent something like this from ever affecting the globe again.
Mr. Berry, thank you so much for talking to AM.
Thank you, Sabra, and thanks for your listeners and for the amazing Australian support we've received here in the U.S. I got to tell you, there's every Australian business in the city of New York has stepped up and done things that would make you so proud. Simple things like Bluestone Lane, donating coffee to hospitals. Van Leeuwen Ice Cream has donated free ice cream to hospital workers. It's just amazing. Every Australian business here in the city has risen to the occasion, and it would make every Australian proud. And I'll tell you, every New Yorker is grateful for the amazing love and leadership that has been shown by Australia.
Thank you, Mr. Berry.
Thanks, Sabra. Bye-bye now.
That's John Berry, a former US ambassador to Australia. A longer version of that interview will be published on our website. The Northern Territory introduced tough COVID-19 safeguards to protect Australia's First Nations people who are particularly vulnerable to the virus due to high rates of chronic disease. Its borders were shut and travel banned to remote Indigenous communities, with indoor gatherings restricted to no more than 10 people. But some traditional owners say the arrival of police and defence personnel to enforce the rules has been heavy-handed and has instead brought back painful memories. National Indigenous Affairs correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
The outback town of Tennant Creek sits in the middle of the Northern Territory. About half of its 3,000 residents are Indigenous, and as the coronavirus pandemic gripped the nation, special protections were put in place. Military officers and federal police arrived to man borders and assist local police. But traditional owner Jimmy Frank says it stirred up painful memories of the Howard government's intervention.
Our people still having that sort of trauma, and that intervention sort of brought that back. And then with this coronavirus, there was not much consultation in our community, and that really scared people.
Of the 24 COVID-19 infringement notices issued in the Northern Territory, more than half have been in Tennant Creek. Residents fear police are using COVID-19 as an excuse to search their homes. That's rejected by Police Commander Bradley Curry, who says residents have blatantly refused to follow new rules.
Yeah, disappointingly we did see that, and it was really concerning for us, clearly, because we didn't want to see this disease, if it did go through the community, be transmitted very quickly, and that was our main concern. And that was why we engaged with the community first off, and unfortunately those gatherings continued and police took action to ensure that there was further enforcement around that.
The Defence Force has assisted police with COVID-19 compliance checks, but says it has not been involved in law enforcement.
Specifically in Tennant Creek, there was those compliance checking, and the ADF were staying outside. And whilst our officers were doing those checks, clearly they've identified other offences being committed within the Northern Territory legislation, and the NT police officers were taking action against those people that were consuming liquor in those camps.
Amnesty International has received more than a dozen complaints from residents who say they feel discriminated against or racially profiled. It's asked police to explain the tactics used. Rodney Dillon is the group's Indigenous rights advisor.
There's been a constant line of complaints coming from Tennant Creek, and the complaints are pretty much the same, that when a big group of police go to the one house, it's not just panicking the people in that house, it's panicking all the people.
Jimmy Frank says the town suffers from overcrowded housing, so complying with some distancing laws is tough. He also thinks there's been a lack of cultural understanding.
Our Indigenous people got English as a second or third language. We need liaison officers. We need people on the ground where people feel comfortable to go and work with our community.
NT police say any complaint will be investigated.
Isabella Higgins reporting. You know the saying, it's no use crying over spilt milk, but what about beer? Millions of litres of the liquid gold is being poured down drains in Australia. With pubs closed across the country and not due to reopen to large numbers anytime soon, huge quantities of beer is going off in kegs. National rural reporter Caitlin Gribben has our story.
Beer educator and commentator Matt Kierkegaard writes about the amber nectar for a living. Never has he seen the industry in such a slump.
It's been a really brutal time, and we still don't know how many will open once things go back to whatever the new normal is.
Pubs and breweries across Australia have been closed since coronavirus restrictions tightened in late March. The challenge for brewers big and small? Millions of would-be schooners are now slowly going stale in kegs.
One of the things that we don't really think a lot about with beer is having a shelf life, and it's a fairly short shelf life at that. So with pubs now being closed for almost 50 days, we are seeing a lot of that beer starting to come up against some of its use-by dates.
Lovers of a cold one might be shocked to hear that means it's now simply going to waste.
Probably, unfortunately, going to go down the drain. It seems very un-Australian and certainly heartbreaking. It's probably even worse than a beer truck falling over on a highway. I've seen estimations of millions of litres.
One of the largest brewers in Australia, Lion, says the closure of pubs and clubs has been gut-wrenching for the industry. Lion has credited venues for the cost of their unused kegs, and the ABC understands about 90,000 kegs, or more than 10 million schooners of beer, will need to be emptied by Lion. The country's other major brewer, Carlton and United Breweries, is refunding its customers' unopened kegs and providing pubs with bottles to fill beer from kegs. It's not just the big brewers that are feeling the pain. Ben Rylands owns the New England Brewing Company in the small town of Euralla, more than 5 hours northwest of Sydney.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the beer will end up going down the drain. Obviously, it's financial pain, but we're very vested in what we're doing. Pretty heartbreaking.
Further south, Will Tatchell owns Van Diemen Brewing at Evandale, just outside of Launceston, and he's feeling the pinch of the shutdown.
One, it's frustrating. Two, it's annoying. And three, it's sort of our livelihood.
He's adapting his business model by moving beer from kegs into stubbies. That's not cheap because he's paying an increased excise rate, as well as having to buy bottles, labels, caps and cartons.
It's probably a question that I try not to dwell on too much. A rough estimate, it's probably in excess of $25,000 for the period of time that this has occurred. There are means and ways about it. It's just thinking forward, thinking positively and staying ahead of the curve, pardon the pun, in this situation.
Launceston brewer Will Tatchell speaking with our national rural reporter, Caitlin Gribben. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So far, we've been measuring this pandemic in two ways, the number of people killed by the virus and the damage to the economy. But there is a third impact that we're only just beginning to get a sense of, and that's what it's doing to Australia's mental health.
Today on The Signal, the close link between unemployment and the suicide rate, and what steps could be taken now to prevent those deaths in the months and years to come. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.